The word for word for this is the vayu, is the air of life. Anilam, total reservoir, amritam, indestructible. Atta, now. That atta is very powerful because now, when is now that he's talking about in this verse? It's the last moment of death. And it's accumulation, a culmination of everything that we've done in this lifetime. This period that we have in this body, is it has a number on it. There are a certain number of breaths that we get, and there is a final breath. We make many breaths in this lifetime, but there is one final breath that we'll get. And then at that time, it's vital, actually, that we are prepared. And so we're spending a lifetime in preparation. That's what we're doing. And so this atta, we think about it now. Now that the body is being separated from the soul, now that the soul is separating from the body, at that particular juncture, is the Srimad Bhagavatam is being spoken specifically to prepare Maharaj Parikshit for that period of time. And he is saying, Ante Narayana Smritihi, that one should prepare for that last moment so that one can remember God at the end and be in that state of consciousness. So this is not business as usual, what goes on in this world. Normally we're distracted because the preponderance of activity goes towards maintaining the body and the mind. And the senses have their demands over and over again. They really do, actually. Prahlad Maharaj described it like if you had many demanding wives, for instance, he put it the way he put it. When you came home, each one was pulling you in a different direction. The senses are like that. They pull us in all kinds of different directions. And yoga means we have to actually control the senses. And we have to come to the point of seeing ourselves, our real selves, as the priority, and the senses as our second priority, and being able to control the senses. Otherwise, it would be very difficult to come to this point of seeing the difference between the body and the soul and being prepared for atta, or that time when the body's separated. It's just, yes, yes.
I just had a question.
Finished. Give him the mic.
It says, Anilam. Anilam is the total reservoir of air.
So, is Nilam, that's a different Nilam than Anilam. Anilashi, Nilam.
Different word. Vayur anilam amritam. The air of life, the total reservoir of air, amritam, indestructible, atta, now. Now that this is happening, idam, this, bashmantam, after being turned into ashes, shariram, the body, om, O Lord, krato, O enjoyer of all sacrifices, smara, please remember, kratam, all that has been done by me, smara, please remember, krato, O supreme beneficiary, smara, please remember, kratam, all that I have done for you, smara, please remember. So it's an interesting prayer because oftentimes the devotees are asking, please let me remember you. And now at the end, this devotee is saying, my Lord, please remember me. Please remember that I've dedicated my life to you. And this can come up because we might not be able to see clearly the personality of Godhead and how he's working exactly. And the devotee wants to be absolutely sure that he's connected to the Lord. So we may have this prayer. And as it will be pointed out in the purport, for the sincere devotee who's spent his life or her life dedicated to this process, Or actually, even if someone's dedicated even a little bit during one's lifetime, the Lord doesn't forget that. Gajendra realized that when he was in a severe condition of being dragged into the water by the crocodile, and he noted that actually the Lord's always attentive and he takes everything into account, especially if we do something towards his service. It's cumulative, and the Lord doesn't forget it. So Prabhupada points out here that's actually not necessary for the devotee to ask the Lord, "Oh, please remember what I've done for you." And he also points out that, Hare Krishna, he also points out that even if the devotee happens to forget the Lord at the time of death due to dislocation of the senses or some distraction, you know, that can be there, that the Lord will remember the devotee and will make sure that the devotee remembers the Lord. And we've seen it with devotees. It can be also a situation that you're in at the time of death. I mean, all the situations that we're in this life are arranged by someone. We may think we're arranging them, but they're being arranged by the modes of material nature. And for devotees, the devotees see how the Lord is making arrangements for us. And we've seen with devotees how at the end the Lord will make an arrangement so that the devotee is surrounded by other devotees or is in a place where he or she can't forget the Lord. So the purport: the temporary material body is certainly a foreign dress. We could just go home with that and meditate on those words. How many words are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So everyone has to memorize those. That's on page 123 and 124 in the purport, the first sentence. So let's just have a discussion about the first sentence, because this is really the beginning point of spiritual life. And what is the first sentence? Okay. So does anybody have some realization about that? That you want to talk about? Yes.
I know the understanding that we are not this human body is coming to me in many different forms. And this is particularly revealing just because we do every day put on new clothes. And, I never think that I'm this shirt, I'm this pants. And it's so easy to get wrapped up and thinking that we're this material body, but that it will just be shed someday. And it's every day something more clear, like that this body is like clothing, that it's not us. It's just driving the point home for me that this material body is not who I am. And that's something that I love learning in different ways like this.
So Jonathan, thank you very much, has given us a very powerful metaphor. And let's look it up in the Bhagavad Gita, because this is something that we can always go to, as Krishna gives us this personally in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where he tells Arjuna that really the body that we have now is just like clothes. And it changes every day. It changes every day. It's like in a dream, you know, when you have a dream, things change very rapidly usually, right? You're changing, first of all, you know, you're walking down the street and then you find a treasure and then somebody's chasing you and then, you know, you jump over a fence and you're in the ocean or, you know, anything can happen, change. The material, our external, when we're in our waking consciousness, everything's changing also, right? Just maybe a little slower. But it's also a dreamlike state. And the idea that we're the body is really actually, if we think about it carefully, the body is not something stable at all. It's not something stable at all. We just sort of assume that it is, but it's not at all. And, of course, Krishna begins his discussion of this with Dehino Sminyata Dehe, Komar Anyavadam Jara, Tata Dehantara Praptir Tiras Tatra Namuyati. And that verse number is verse number 13 in the second chapter on page 83. And this means a deha, the dehinaha, means of the embodied, the person who's embodied. So that's us. We're the person who's actually embodied. So there's a difference between the person and the vehicle and the body. And this is the essence of spiritual life, to see the difference between these two. So dehina means this physical machine, the body. Asmin means in this. So we're actually in it. We're in that machine. And then he gives the yata, means as is a simile. So just as dehe in the body, komaran means boyhood, yovanam youth, jara old age. Now that's something we can relate to, because we can watch it in ourselves, how we've gone through boyhood to youth to old age. And everyone does it. Cats do it, dogs do, squirrels, monkeys, worms. They all go through this transformation stage, so the body's changing, and you can see the different stages. So Krishna's saying, just as you go through these changes from boyhood to youth to old age, so then he gives us this, just as tata. So this is one of those yata tata verses. So just as, therefore, similarly. Similarly, so just as we change from boyhood to youth to old age, Krishna says, deha antara. So deha again means the body. And antara means at the end. So the body will have an end. And we're not sure when that is, but it will. It does have an end. So at that deha antara, Krishna says, prapti, achievement, dhira, the sober, tatra, thereupon, na, never, muyati. So that means that in the transference at the end of life, at the body, a person who is not bewildered isn't disturbed by the change. This is the whole lesson of life right here, is that we're in the body, and the body is changing from boyhood to youth to old age, and it will come to an end. And the goal is not to be bewildered by that change. Otherwise, extremely bewildered. And let's look at something in the 15th chapter about this process of changing the body and how one who's educated does not become bewildered. And someone who's not educated in spiritual science becomes bewildered. So if you turn to page number 639, text number 8, Krishna says, go to 640, the living entity in the material world carries his different conceptions of life from one body to another as the air carries aromas. Thus he takes one kind of body and again quits it to take another. Let's repeat this. I'll say it, then you say it. The living entity in the material world carries his different conceptions of life from one body to another as the air carries aromas. Thus he takes one kind of body and again quits it to take another. So another analogy to remember, just as the air carries aromas from one place to another, we carry our conception of life from one body to the next, from one deha to the next deha. Now, he becomes more specific in the next verse. The living entity thus taking another gross body. See, there's a difference, because there's a gross body And there's a subtle body, and then there's the soul. There's two coverings of the soul. There's the subtle covering, which is called the subtle body. And there's the gross covering, which is the gross body. And what is the gross body made of, actually? As Krishna says, okay, stool, but in more Sankhya terms, earth, water, fire, air, ether. Okay? So ether may be a subtle element. So we've got earth, water, fire, air. These gross elements make up this body. Now we can analyze it. You really can see that that's what makes up the body. If you analyze it, you'll see that the body really is made up of these things, and that that's not me. I'm different from the deha. The deha has, it has water, lots of it. I think I can hear it. I can feel it, you know. It's the body is water. And really, you know, this is a bag, really, full of water. It's intricate, and it's got all kinds of, you know, channels and everything going through it. But it's mostly body, water, because if you take all the water out, what do you get? You get a little box of, you know, of like earth, carbon, really. Carbon, earth, right? So you get earth. When you take away the water, you get about this much earth. Even from if you took, you know, Shaquille O'Neal and burn, you might get a little bigger box, but it's mostly water. Nothing, no harm to you, Shaquille, I mean. But the fact is, it is earth, water, and then fire. The fire is there. You can feel the heat. It's going on in the body, fire, air, circulating in the lungs and everything like so. So that's not us. That's a separate thing. And then we have the subtle body, which becomes a little trickier to see that we're not that, because, you know, we'll say you're not your body. We'll say, all right, then I'm my mind. I'm my thoughts. Right? Isn't that the next thing? I think I'm my thoughts. But you're actually observing your thoughts also. And your thoughts come and go, and certain desires even come and go at times. And you can see, wait a minute, where'd that come from? That wasn't me. You know, one minute you want to kill somebody, and the next minute you go like, oh, why did I think that? I shouldn't have acted in that way. We can observe the coming and goings of the subtle body as well. So in this verse 9, the living entity, thus taking another gross body, obtains a certain type of ear, eye, tongue, nose, and sense of touch, which are grouped about the mind. He thus enjoys a particular set of sense objects. So pigs like a certain kind of thing. They have senses that can actually handle certain types. I'm being general here, but pigs, all right, pigs eat stool. And they walk around all day and they wallow in stool. If we did that even for half an hour, we'd become sick. And we're not accustomed to it. We wouldn't like it either. But a pig gets a particular set of senses so he can enjoy in that environment. And everyone gets a particular set of senses so they can enjoy in a particular set of sense objects. Then, in text 10, the foolish cannot understand how a living entity can quit his body, nor can they understand what sort of body he enjoys under the spell of the modes of nature. But one whose eyes are trained in knowledge can see all this. So here it is, the word vimudha nanupashyanti. A vimudha, what's a mudha?
Fool.
And what's a vimudha? When you put V on, right, as Narhari Prabhu is telling us, it emphasizes it. So Krishna's saying this thing. Mudha means like an ass. You're foolish. You don't know why you're coming and going. You don't know what's going on. You're oblivious. And vimudha is an emphasizer. It means very foolish. So vimudha nanupashyanti. That means that the very foolish person cannot see what's taking place when one leaves the body and takes another body. But somebody else can see it. And who is that person? Pashyanti jnana chakshusa. So what does that mean? What's chakshu?
Eyes.
Yeah, and what's jnana? So somebody whose eyes have been opened by knowledge. Pashyanti. They can see it. So let's just talk about this a little bit, because how is it somebody can become trained in knowledge and then they can actually see what's taking place? Do you have any comments about that? Maybe an experience you've had where you've been trained in knowledge. In other words, you've heard something from the Bhagavad Gita and then you've been able to observe it in a different way that you hadn't seen it before, or a different way from the way other people are seeing it. Yeah, Rakshit.
Well, one is coming to the realization, an actual realization, not just theoretical, that I am the living entity who is separate from the body, which Krishna says is the soul. That is one type of understanding. It's book understanding, theoretical understanding. But to come to actual understanding is then becoming aware that I, the living entity, and that who is separate from the body and hence would be able to observe. One example that can be given is when I wake up from my sleep, I would be able to say what kind of a sleep I had, whether I had a restful sleep or whether it was disturbed. And when I say I become aware, I become aware that my mind and body were sleeping, and I, as the living entity, made that observation. That I had a restful sleep or a disturbed sleep. And the other example which you gave is that I'm able to see my body changing, so that today I'm of a certain age and I can look back and see the transformations that my body has gone through. So I've separated myself from the body and I've been able to make this observation. When this happens in actuality, rather than just theoretically, in actuality, I know that I have gone through these transformations. I'm not changing, my body is changing. Then I've become more aware that I'm separate from my body. I'm able to make some observations like this to be able to comment how well I slept at night and also how my body is today than what it was 5 years ago.
Thank you. I can relate to the one especially about sleeping in a practical way. In fact, I wrote something about this when I was in college about how oftentimes when I'm sleeping, especially when I'm napping, I get this experience between being asleep and coming back awake again. Just want to see if any of you have had this before too. But a lot of times when I'm just maybe in the afternoon taking a nap or something like that, and I have had this experience, like I'm in my living room on the couch or something, and I take a nap for, let's say, 20 minutes or something. And then, you know that period of time between when you're actually under sleeping and when you come back to external consciousness, and there's sort of a, there's a mid period there. What?
Twilight.
A twilight, yeah, between sleeping and waking. When I look around and I go like, these aren't all my things. What am I doing here? You know? Have you had that? I've talked to Satyadeva about this before. You know, this, what is sleep and, you know, where do we go actually? There's a way in which I can actually feel that, you know, sort of the, almost, it almost feels like a burden of all these things. I look out and I go, look at all these things. What a burden. Because I'm feeling sort of the subtlety of my, you know, difference between the body and coming back into the body. So yeah, this is very true, this idea of sleeping. Jiva Goswami talks about this in the Tattvasandarbha, actually. I read some of that while Kesha Bharti Maharaj was editing that. And he gives this example that you just gave about coming from sleeping and then becoming awake again. And you're the one observing that you were asleep and that you came awake. These are practical things, seeing we're not the body. And yes, Satya.
I was just thinking of this example too, you know, that just even in a mundane sense, you know, if we're ignorant about, you know, just like when I used to go out on the street, I get up on a scene and someone would say to me, like the cops or a bystander would say, I think this person's dead. And I look at them from a distance and think, no, this person's faking something. You know, they look fine to me.
Because you had eyes of knowledge.
Yeah. So if you don't know about a particular, or, you know, a young kid may think, you know, the tooth fairy left, you know, money under my pillow because they don't know what's going on. But once you're even, you know, even for a person who begins to study, you know, hear Krishna's words in the Bhagavad Gita and begins to hear these explanations, or we learn about the three modes of material nature before, we don't know anything, but once it's explained to us, then we begin to see
how it's working.
First being explained to us, then we remain in ignorance.
It's very true, just in regular daily life, when we have some knowledge about what's going on. You gave the example last time of a magic trick. If you actually know how it works and you have eyes of knowledge. I got taken in one time when I was a kid. You know the people, they do these three cards, two red, two black, and one white. They flip them like this. You never had that? They're really good at it. They know how to palm the cards. And I'm looking and I go, I know where it is. I go, okay, put your money in. Put my money in, and I didn't know where it was. But later on, when I figured out how they were doing the trick and everything, then it became, not that I could guess where they're going to do it, because they're so good at it, but at least I knew that it was, you know, it was an illusion. And you have eyes of knowledge. Of course, I didn't do it again after that. But jnana chakshusha means we have to actually become fortified, eyes of knowledge, to see really what's going on. And we have to hear from Krishna to tell us. He's the authority that tells us what's going on. Because so many people have speculation about what might be going on and guesses about, well, what does death really mean? What does it mean when you leave the body? But we have, if we take it from the authority, from Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita, exactly what's going on, then we won't be foolish and we won't be bewildered at the time of death. Even if we don't have complete realization that I'm not my body, which is a very difficult thing. I pulled down the third canto, part two of the Srimad Bhagavatam, because in it, Devahuti is speaking to her exalted son, who is an incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. His name was Kapila. And in her questions to him, she said, it's very difficult to extricate myself from the body because it seems like it's one thing. Even to people who are advanced in knowledge or who are trying for it, it seems like it's one thing, doesn't it? At one minute I'm thinking, yeah, I'm not my body, and the next minute I think, yeah, but, you know, I kind of am. I remember when Ma Muni Prabhu was sick once, and he had some really high fever. It was in the St. Louis Brahmacharya Ashram. He was moaning, I think, on the floor. Of course, we always slept on the floor. And, you know, he was really suffering, and he made some moaning noise. And one of the new brahmacharis that was there said, Prabhu, you know you're not your body. Easy to tell someone else when they're sick, right? And Ma Muni rolled over and he goes, Prabhu, you're not my body either. So, you know, this practical knowledge, we may be trained in it, you know, and it's still, when the fever comes or when death comes, we may also have to, you know, go through it and you know, review what Krishna said to us. And in that way, see, with eyes of knowledge, that's how we have to make our way through the world, is to actually take shelter of the Bhagavad Gita, how Krishna has spoken it. And we won't be mistaken if we do that. This jnana chakshusha means that we take this, also it's also called shastra chakshusha, which means that our eyes, our vision, the way we move in the world comes from shastra. Because oftentimes, you know, someone might say, oh, it's like this. And that comes from their own empirical speculation. But if you take it like that, you'll make a mistake. But if you take it from Krishna, we won't make a mistake. So he's, yes, Prabhuji.
I'm still not clear, like the statement, nor can they understand what sort of body he enjoys under the spell of the modes of nature. So actually, even I'm not clear. Can you maybe speak a little more on that?
Yeah, the material nature is, it's like being under a spell, because how is it, there's two potencies that are mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. One's the throwing potency, and the other's the covering potency. Maya has these two distinctions of potencies. So one potency is we're thrown away from our real self-interest and the shelter of the internal energy. And the other one is that Maya can cover us. And that's like being under a spell. Like, you know, sometimes they describe, like, there's all kinds of songs that, you know, if you look through modern pop culture, all the songs people sing about so-called being in love, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she's a black magic woman. That was from the 60s. Carlos Santana wrote that song. You know, it's like under some kind of spell. And there's so many songs that, and you know, about this whole idea. It's like I'm under this, you know, I'm under somebody's spell. Well, if you look in the Bhagavad Gita, you can tell what kind of spell you're under. The mode of goodness, the mode of passion, the mode of ignorance. These are like spells. You know, we think I'm enjoying this thing. I like jazz because, you know, I'm a cool cat. Really, you know. You like jazz because you're under a certain kind of spell of the modes of material nature. Let's look at in the 17th chapter. This is where Krishna talks about how material nature puts us under a spell. And when we come out of that spell and we become Krishna conscious, this comes to the point of Shuddha Sattva. We're beyond even the spell of the mode of goodness. But mode of goodness makes us, you know, become attached to knowledge and happiness and, you know, in a certain mode in the material world. But beyond that, actually, we come to our spiritual standing. We actually have an eternal standing. This material world is called vriksha, because vriksha means tree, and a tree means something that will be cut off. And in fact, Krishna describes the whole material world as a banyan tree, and we're entangled in it. And the banyan tree really, in one way, it's something that will be cut off. It's not permanent. Really, the breathing of Mahavishnu is going on, and bhutva praliyate, every manifestation that comes about in this world that we identify with will eventually be dissolved. In the Bible, there are descriptions about how this whole conception of material life, it's a vapor. It's described like that. It's like, what is a vapor? You know, it looks like something. No, it just dissipates. Over and over, it's dissipating, like in a dream. So But we're under a spell. We have a conception of life. We think something's important. And why? Because we're into this control of the modes of nature. So the divisions of faith, on page 681, Krishna says, well, Arjuna asks, what is the situation of those who do not follow the principles of Scripture but worship according to their own imagination? Are they in goodness, passion, or in ignorance? Krishna answers, according to the modes of nature acquired by the embodied soul, one's faith can be of three kinds, in goodness, in passion, or in ignorance. Now hear about this. O son of Bharata, according to one's existence under the various modes of nature, one evolves a particular kind of faith. The living being is said to be of a particular faith according to the modes he has acquired. So, Shraddha Mayo Yam Purusho, in this verse number 3, really means that a person becomes his faith. He's made of his faith. That's what he has, faith. And in the modes of nature, there's faith. And when one comes to the platform of Shuddha Sattva, there's pure faith, or an actual pure conception of who we are. We have a real standing that's not subject to the changing modes of material nature. In this world, it's like reality is imposed on a pot of water, like the moon, you know, it's on the pot of water, and the moon doesn't move, but the pot of water and the water inside is moving, so it appears the moon is shimmering and moving and all kinds of becoming distorted. Sometimes it looks like, oh, look at the moon. It's like, no, the moon's steady. It's in one place. But in the pot of water, it moves like that. So according to the modes we've acquired, it can move, it can, you know, be distorted in many different ways in our conception of life. is according to how we've acquired different modes. And how do we acquire modes of material nature? According to your faith, but how do you get those? How do you acquire them?
From like your conception in your previous life.
And where does that conception come from? Conception means it's your way of seeing something. Conception means you see things in a certain way. But I'm saying, where do you get it from? How do you get it? Huh? Can you prove that? You can prove it. It's in the Bhagavad Gita. Let's have the proof, though. There's a verse that will help us in the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, verse number 20, 1320 we can turn to. Prakritim Purusha Chaiva. No, sorry, that's not it. It'll be number 22 on page 589. Purusha Prakritisto hi bhunkte prakriti jan gunan karanam gunasangosya sarasad yoni janmasu. This proves that our particular faith, our conception, and our acquisition of a particular mode of nature comes from our association. The living entity and the material nature thus follows the ways of life, enjoying the three modes of material nature. This is due to his association with that material nature. Thus he meets with good and evil among various species. So there's the answer. That's how we acquire different conceptions of life. How?
With association with the modes of material nature.
Does everyone agree? How do we attain our different conceptions of life?
By association with a particular mode of nature.
And where are those modes of nature found? How do we identify those particular modes of material nature? And how do we know we're associating with a particular mode? Huh?
The modes of nature are described in this 13th chapter.
13th chapter? Okay. Yes? 14th chapter? 17th chapter? 18th chapter? They all give, Krishna's giving indications about what are the symptoms of a person, for instance, who has determination that's in the mode of goodness. How can you tell if someone has determination in the mode of goodness? What is the symptom?
He's attached to happiness. He's always...
Well, I'm talking specifically about determination. But you're giving a nice definition of what the mode of goodness is like.
Unbreakable.
It's unbreakable. He has a sense of duty, right? I'm doing my duty. I'm going to do it no matter what. The mode of goodness, unshakable. How about in the mode of passion? This doesn't feel very good. Maybe I'll do it another time. I'll do something else. This isn't making me happy anymore. I think I'll go do some other duty. And how about the mode of ignorance?
Don't do anything.
Just ignore.
Determined to be an illusion.
Determined to be an illusion. And that they're, you know, they can't get off the mat. They can't get up and do it. They have no, their determination's broken at every minute.
They dream nonstop. Continually dreaming.
Dreaming.
I'll do this, I'll do that, but never do it.
Never happens. So if you associate with a person in the mode of ignorance, what happens? You'll acquire that mode. If you associate with somebody in the mode of passion, you'll acquire that mode. You associate with a person in the mode of goodness, you'll acquire that. Has anybody had experience of this? When I associate with Satyadev, I know it. When we travel to Japan together, when I come home, I go, man, I'm different. I have better habits, you know. I eat more butter than I usually do. Really, it's true. I never eat butter, but after a couple weeks with Satyadev, because he likes butter. You know, he puts butter on stuff and stuff. After about, you know, 3 or 4 days, I go, I wonder why I don't eat butter. Maybe I should eat butter. Yeah, I'll try some butter. You know, when I get home, it's like, here, Nukula, give me some butter. You know, you don't eat butter. Well, I was just with Satyadev for 2 weeks. You start eating butter. It's just what happened. Somebody had their hand up. Ramaswamy? You were going to say something?
No, I don't have it.
Pass the butter? Okay. You were going to say? Go ahead, use the microphone.
This happens generally at work, especially during like lunch breaks, when I'm not having lunch by myself and trying to read or listen to bhajan or a lecture, when I'm just associating with some of my colleagues.
you know, the topics that they talk about, like sometimes it can be about the economy or the stock market, I become so passionate after that association that, you know, I start thinking, you know, I'm going to suffer if the economy is going bad or something like that.
That's true, yeah.
But then, you know, somehow when I come back in the association of devotees, then I...
Then you can acquire pure faith. Because if you associate with somebody whose goal in life is to cultivate Krishna consciousness, sakshat bhakti, they're steady in hearing and chanting, and they're finding value in it. That's where they're getting their happiness in life. You get around them, they go, oh, that's what I should be doing. I had the same experience. When traveling, I stopped over and I visited someone on my way to India, going and coming, who is very focused on making money and was absorbed a lot in like being on the internet for stocks and, you know, what was the best investment and talking about it all the time. So I found that after I left there, I was thinking, like, maybe I should make a few investment moves, you know. Really, I mean, I just couldn't help it. The association's there. And on the other hand, you know, when you meet somebody who's absorbed in chanting, and they talk about it, and they, you know, that's what they want to do is kirtan all the time. You know, it's like they're doing kirtan for hours or something. And then you go like, oh yeah, that's what I should be doing. You know, kirtan. So factually, we're very subtle. You know, the soul is very subtle, and we can be easily controlled. Really. We're described as tatastha shakti. Tatastha really means neither here nor there. We'll go whichever way the wind blows, really. So, but we do have an independence, a way of becoming dhira, of controlling the senses and determining our future by picking our association very carefully, and knowing through jnana chakshu and through shastra chakshu, having these eyes to know where the modes are, where the trouble's going to be. Like, Jonathan, can you grab me on the far left of this third, Nectar of Instruction. Obviously, you've been studying it. This Nectar of Instruction, this is the essence of instructions on bhakti, and there are certain instructions here, if we just remember them and we practice them, like, one's devotional service is spoiled. Does anybody want to know how your devotional service is spoiled? Do you want to know?
Yes.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to tell you. When he becomes too entangled in the following six activities. Now, he's boiled it down to six activities that will spoil your bhakti. You sure you want to hear these? All six? Number one. Eating more than necessary or collecting more funds than required. Eating more than necessary or collecting more funds than required. Number two, over-endeavoring for mundane things that are very difficult to obtain. Number three, talking unnecessarily about mundane subject matters. Number four, practicing the scriptural rules and regulations only for the sake of following them and not for the sake of spiritual advancement, or rejecting the rules and regulations of the scriptures and working independently or whimsically. That takes a lot of reflection and maturity to appreciate that particular instruction. Because there's a way in which when we start something, we generalize everything. Like, I remember when I was studying writing and I discovered the semicolon. I put semicolons on the whole page and the professor looked at it and said, you know, you might want to not use the semicolon so much. Or exclamation point. You know, neophytes, new people in any kind of discipline tend to, you know, say, oh yeah, this is the only way, and, you know, there's only one way to do it, and not accommodate all kinds of other people, and maybe also follow the rules and regulations without being really clear what they are. And therefore, it's a lifetime of experience that actually, as we stick to bhakti and we go through difficult times even, as we were talking at the very beginning of the class, this instruction from the Shirish Upanishad, vidyam cha vidyam cha yas. This is gold. You should remember this verse, text number 11. Vidyam cha vidyam cha yas tadvedo bayam saha. Avidyaya ratum tirdva. Vidyayam ratum ashnute. Powerful. Only one who can learn the process of nescience and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death. The influence of repeated birth and death. And enjoy the full blessings of immortality. So, side by side means that we go on cultivating this knowledge even though we're in ignorance. And that means we're going to have problems. But those problems will give us strength. Even though we're cultivating this bhakti, because we're in ignorance, we're steeped in ignorance, it's side by side. We're doing it side by side. That's what the verse is telling us. You have no choice because you're already in ignorance. We're souls that started off in the material energy. Therefore, we're doing this side by side. So you can expect to, from time to time, being engulfed by ignorance or making missteps or things might happen that seem contrary to what you thought was going to happen or was supposed to happen or the way the Shastra said it was going to happen. And then you have to reconcile that by continuing to cultivate transcendental knowledge, and that makes you stronger. You get a full experience of actually how everything works because of the fact that you're going on cultivating. And actually, those problems, they end up helping. They make us stronger. Yes, Rakshit Prabhu.
When you mentioned that, I was reminded that this was also the instruction or the position that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu agreed with Ramananda Roy about in the age of Kali Yuga, what should be the highest thing that a person can do, or what should be the nature of devotional service. And he said that because it is Kali Yuga, it is not possible to gradually bring about change in people. Actually, what is advised is that people should stay in their position but take up devotional service. Not change their position, but do a little bit of devotional service. Because if they do that, then it will get them out of this rut.
Shall we look the verse up? That's a really nice point. This would be from, if you open your shloka books here, and you go to the Srimad Bhagavatam 10th canto, 14th chapter. Who knows who spoke the verses in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto? Lord Brahma. 255 is your page. Thanks to Srivas Pandit, our resident Pandit. And we have this very important verse from Lord Brahma. And if you want a treat for your devotional service, go to the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, 14th chapter. Which chapter?
14.
Which canto?
10th
canto. And read that chapter once a month, once a week, once a day. Whatever you like. There's a real treat waiting for you in there. All the basics of the Vaishnava Siddhanta are contained within that chapter. And here's one of the very important verses which was given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which Rakshit Prabhu so kindly brought out for us. Jnane prayasam udapase namante eva jivanti san mukaritam bhavadiyavartam stane stita shutigatam danuvan manobhir I prayasho jita jito pyasitais trilokyam. Those who, even while remaining situated in their established social positions, throw away the process of speculative knowledge and with their body, words, and mind offer all respect to descriptions of your personality and activities, dedicating their lives to these narrations, which are vibrated by you personally and by your pure devotees, certainly conquer your lordship, although you are otherwise unconquerable by anyone within the three worlds. So the point that Rakshit Prabhu is bringing out, stane stita shrutigatam tanuvan manobhir. You can't artificially change, or it's not recommended here by Lord Brahma, and that's Lord Chaitanya brought this verse out, that you don't have to make so many external adjustments. But if while you're in your position, you cultivate spiritual knowledge, especially by hearing and rendering service, then you will extricate yourself from that position eventually, to the point that you'll attract Krishna's attention. And he'll actually be conquered by your degree of love. He'll be attracted to that. So this is a very nice instruction, and it goes along well with what we're talking about, the staying in this position. Satya Prabhu has a point.
It's more of a question. So
shouldn't we pick our battles according to our strengths? I mean, there's some battles, if we don't have an army, you don't have any weapons, or the enemy's just going to wipe you out. And I was thinking of in the story of Gajendra, Prabhupada points out in there that the crocodile, even though the elephant's more powerful than a crocodile, because the elephant was not in its natural habitat, it was in the crocodile's environment, therefore the crocodile became stronger. Before Prabhupada recommends that, it's suitable, for the sannyasa ashram, maybe prematurely or materially you took sannyas. And he says, better to go back to the grihastha ashram, where you're, because of your nature, you'll be actually in a more suitable environment so that you'll be stronger to wage battle against Maya.
So this goes along with the point, actually, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, emphasizes this point that Prabhupada makes in the 9th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, where, 8th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, in which there was a fight between Gajendra and the crocodile, as if you've heard any of my classes, you've probably heard over 1,000 times, the elephant's stronger than the crocodile, but in the water, the crocodile's stronger than the elephant. And therefore, Prabhupada pointed out that to fight with Maya, we should find where we feel the strongest. So at the time he wrote that, there was cases where devotees had prematurely taken sannyas and then given that ashram up and may have become discouraged. And Prabhupada said, don't be discouraged. Find the place where you feel the strongest, where you feel you can fight Maya. And everyone has a certain psychophysiological nature. I mean, some people naturally feel very comfortable in a brahmachari ashram. And, it is a very comfortable place, very simple life. You get to eat with your friends every day. You don't have any real pressing matters other than doing your service. It's really joyful. But somebody might be agitated in that environment, and they might need something, some other kind of surrounding. So it's not a hindrance if one makes an adjustment and lives in a situation where he or she can feel comfortably psychologically to go on hearing and chanting and carrying on. The main point is to keep cultivating this process, wherever you are. Grihe tako, bani tako, shada hari boli tako, suke duke, bulonako, varane harinam kore. This advice will carry us through this one lifetime, actually. It means wherever you are, go on chanting. It's that simple. And if you're happy or distressed, and the fact of the matter is, the material world means you're going to be happy one minute and distressed the next, at least externally. Anyway, there's no way to avoid it. You just cannot avoid it. It comes along with the body. You're going to get a certain amount of happiness and a certain amount of distress. And even though you don't ask for it, it's going to come right at you. The happiness is going to come, the so-called happiness of the material world. People are going to come dump money on you, or they're going to come give you some, favorable situation, and somebody's going to come and take it away. And it'll waver back and forth. Every time I ever looked at my astrological chart, it's always like, okay, what's in there? And the people reading it, you know, it's like, okay, you're going to be happy, and then you're going to be distressed. It's going to be up, it's going to be down. It's like terrorism experts. They get on the CNN. It's like, so what do you think? Like, well, they could attack any minute now. Thank you, sir. Thanks for your help. Kind of experts. That we know the material world, there's happiness and distress. It's going to come no matter what. And the point is, keep chanting Hare Krishna. Put yourself in this position where you keep chanting to the degree that you can do it. And the more that you can stay steady at that, the more you'll actually feel for yourself a real standing in spiritual life. There are obstacles we have to move gradually. And the more we remove the obstacles, we'll experience a real standing for ourselves. Prabhupada told certain devotees about, you know, like in the beginning when they said, it's very difficult, follow the four regulator principles. He said it's just like a child. In the very beginning, it's hard to walk, but you keep trying. And after a while, you get strength and you can walk. And when a child's walking, he knows he's walking. Everyone else knows he's walking too. It's not a big mystery. Spiritual life's not a huge mystery either. There are certain obstacles, and in the beginning, we're going to get bowled over by them. Those obstacles we just read about on the way down here. Here are five. These are called the five categories, main categories of anartas. Anartas means what's blocking us from standing on the real ground of spiritual life. What's blocking us from walking the walk in spiritual life without getting knocked over? First one is sleep. Sleep means ignorance. It means that we sleep during kirtan. We sleep during japa. We sleep during smarnam, or hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. We'd rather go to sleep than hear. Yes?
Does that include unconscious also?
Unconscious?
I mean, not conscious, like you said, japa, so not being attentive or not being...
Well, there's also that. Those are other anartas too. But sleep is mentioned. So sleep is number one. And then he mentions distraction. So distraction comes in many different forms. I mean, the mind, Arjuna says, like the wind, it can just sweep us away. We're just sitting there, and all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, you know, you're off somewhere else. And just a minute, we become distracted. So distraction is there. This is an anarta, to become distracted from our spiritual life. Of course, later on, he explains, and this is sort of jumping ahead a little bit, but there's a description of how... in the beginning, when the mind becomes, we're trying to perform bhakti, and our mind gets distracted, and we notice we're in some other realm that's not bhakti. But then we remember and we bring the mind back. And later on, in a more elevated state, when those anartas, that anarta is removed, we're performing bhakti, and someone tries to bring our mind to something else, and it keeps coming back to bhakti, and it's not... how is it? It's like the opposite, right? Yeah. Like in one... Can you explain it a little better?
Well, I just like... Well,
just normally, we're attracted. We have a spontaneous attraction to Maya, so forth. For a man, it would be the form of a woman. Or for a woman, it would be the form of a man.
Or baby.
Or baby or something. Yeah, or baby. You know, just spontaneously we go there. We may be looking at the deities or chanting our japa. One of those spontaneous attractions comes before us. Before we know it, our mind has gone there. So he's saying that a person in nishta will be like that. They may be steady in their devotional service, they may not be overcome by anarthas anymore, but they're spontaneously still attracted to Maya, and not spontaneously attracted to Krishna. But for one who has developed their spontaneous attraction for Krishna, even in the presence of the previous distraction, their mind doesn't go there. It stays fixed.
Yeah, there was something about how... Anyway, it's... That's good enough for now. Thank you. No, it's okay. Anyway, then another anarta is by Vishnu Chakravarti too, is describing how indifference, and we become indifferent to our practice. And then there's the past bad habits which come up. And so habit means second nature. It just, you know, like you're not thinking of doing it, and a certain habit, but, you know, and maybe you've been not doing it, but then say you walk past a, you know, a bag of potato chips and all of a sudden you just grab them and start eating them or something like that. You know, it's like it just bubbles up out of the past, you know, that you've done it before so many times and you're so used to doing a certain habit, it just comes out of you sometimes. So those habits tend to distract us in the unsteady stage of devotional service. And then the fifth one that he's mentioned is a taste for material enjoyment that may take us away from hearing and chanting. In other words, you know, if there's a choice, okay, the Oscars are on. Would you rather do that or go to hear the Bhagavad Gita class? Fortunately, you didn't have to choose tonight, because I think they were on last week or something. But you know, and then he's like, oh no, I'd rather go to see the Oscars. You know, I want to go see the fight. You know, something like that. You have a taste, your taste for material things overcomes your taste for hearing Srimad Bhagavatam or engaging in devotional service. So when these things are removed, then we'll feel steady in devotional service. And in the meantime, we have to tolerate and we have to go on with the process, whether we're in happiness or distress or whether we're being influenced by those anartas or not, we have to pick ourselves up and keep going with the process. And we also should find a situation in which is the most favorable for us to hear and chant. As Satyadeva Prabhu said, we should pick our battles. I think we need do we have enough air in this room? Because the last 20 minutes are the most essential. Who needs more air? Raise your hand. Who needs less air? Who doesn't care if they breathe or not? Maybe we just have a little tiny bit of air. Maybe that'll help. That's full speed. Maybe one more time. Because one time means full speed. Okay.
Yeah, they're cooking, so the oil's on.
Hopefully ghee.
Butter.
Butter? Okay, butter's all right. So he doesn't mind butter. Okay, so coming back to the original point, we were going to look up a verse from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which was a description of how we're changing our body, in which Krishna says, it's just like changing your clothes. And that verse happens to be 22. On page 94. Thank you, Raksha Prabhu. Vasamshi jirnani yata vihaya navani granati naroparani tata sharirani vihaya jirnani adyani samyati navani dehi. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. So, really, the body is just like a dress, and we're changing it one after another, one after another, one after another. And if we have eyes of knowledge and we understand this, that this body is just a, you know, a garment that we're changing, then our perspective and our values, everything will change accordingly. And we can do that. Oh, and I was in the middle. Let me finish. I'm digressing in so many ways. And number five, associating with worldly-minded persons who are not interested in Krishna consciousness. What am I describing?
The six problems.
Six things that destroy devotional service. It actually destroys them. Vinashati means devotional bhakti is destroyed by these things. So number five was associating with worldly-minded persons who are not interested in Krishna consciousness. Can somebody give me a description? What does it mean to be worldly minded?
Donald Trump?
Donald Trump, do you know Donald? He might be worldly minded. Do you have any personal experience, huh?
Those who are interested in just making money
and
enjoying the material pleasures.
Okay. Mata, that might be a little distracting, sorry. So making money could be a worldly, just interested in making money? Okay. Anybody have any personal experience of feeling worldly minded? Or yes?
Well,
just attesting to the fact that you've experienced it. What does it feel like?
Fearful.
Want to say anything more about that? Give her the microphone. It's fearful, okay. Fear comes when we misidentify ourselves with the material body. Bhayam dvitiya vinibhesha tasya, says the Srimad Bhagavatam. Fear arises when we identify with something other than Krishna. And we try to take shelter of something that's non-Krishna, then we become fearful. So this is a nice point you've made here. This is one of the symptoms of being worldly minded. Somebody who's fearful. Devotees are not fearful. Right? Can you prove that? From the Srimad Bhagavatam that devotees don't have any fear? Gauranga Kishore can prove it. You can look in your shloka book if you want. Narayana paraksarve nakutashchana bibiti swarga pavarga narakeshu apituliana darshana. You know, there's 231? Thank you. Page 231 in these shloka books that Ananda Rupa Prabhu brought back from India for us. Let's give a hand to Ananda Rupa Prabhu. Haribol. You know, just remembering that every little thing that we have in this temple room was a victory and a personal accomplishment done, you know, as teamwork. You know, you look around and see like this bookshelf. I remember when we were just getting these bookshelves together and Hansapriya went out and bought them and had them assembled. And we had one and then we decided we needed two, right? This floor we're sitting on, this was a result. I think Jananivas Prabhu got the money together and made sure this floor, it was a whole endeavor to put the floor in. The temple we're sitting in now, that, you know, it took a long time to find it. Everything in here, all these lights, Jananivas put all these in here, you know, personally. Every one of these fans that we're sitting under, these books that we're holding in our hand, Ananda Rupa Prabhu brought them back personally from Bombay. And so, I mean, everything, I'm just bringing this point up as an aside point, but everything we have here is special and important. Every little bit of advancement we've made took a lot of work and trouble, and it's meaningful, it's very meaningful. It all creates this environment that we're in now so that we can peacefully hear and chant, and that we can bring others into the environment. And this is our occupation here, is how to constantly make it better. And there's unlimited service in that way. You know, there's all kinds of ways that we can improve and make it better, and everything counts. This is service. It's real seva. So this verse that Srivas Pandit Prabhu, our resident pandit, found for us on page 231, says, devotees solely engaged in the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan, never fear any condition of life. For them, the heavenly planets, liberation, and the hellish planets are all the same. For such devotees are interested only in the service of the Lord. Yes?
I have a question.
Yes.
Well,
give him the mic.
Yeah. It makes me think of a lecture I was listening to recently by His Grace Devamrita Swami. He was pointing out that it's actually a sign of intelligence for one to be afraid of the material world. And then I was just thinking, when you were saying that, I was thinking of Nrisimhadev, when Sri Prahlad, you know, when he was asked, why aren't you afraid of me? And he says, you know, I'm not afraid of you. It's this world that I'm afraid of. You know, and so I was thinking about my guru's lecture where he's saying that it's actually
seventh canto. Seven. Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you could say something about that.
It's a different kind of fear. One is fear in understanding how strong Krishna's Maya is and knowing that my real interest is to go back home, back to Godhead, and therefore I don't want to become caught up again in the material world. And the other kind of fear is a gut-wrenching, constant kind of fear that at any second I can lose what's mine, which is illusion, because I really don't have anything. But, you know, it's just like as soon as you get money in this world, the first fear is if you're attached to it, the first fear is I'm going to lose it. It's like when the stock market was really going up, not recently, but a while ago, and people were making a lot of money from real estate and all kinds of things. What was the one of the main things they were talking about? When's it going to go down again? This can't last. It's all going to go down. There's constant fear in the when you're attached to the body and to the conception of material life. It's different from the kind of fear that Prahlad Maharaj talks about in this prayer. And I'll read you the prayer that Jagat Jivan Prabhu so kindly brought up. This is a very nice prayer to remember because Srila Prabhupada himself, at one time he was praying before the deities and some tears were coming to his eyes. And the devotees had asked him, Prabhupada, can you tell us, you know, what kind of prayer you're saying to the deity when you're crying like that, you know, when you're in that mood? And Srila Prabhupada told the devotees that I'm praying to Krishna that I don't fall into Maya. And then some other devotee was a little confused because previously Prabhupada said, well, a pure devotee can't fall into Maya. They said, but Prabhupada, you said that a devotee can't fall into, a pure devotee doesn't fall into Maya, so why would you be praying to Krishna? And he said, that's why. Because the pure devotee is always thinking like that and praying to Krishna in that way. So here's a couple of verses. Prahlad says, Naham bibhem yajita te tabayana kasya jivarka netra brukuti rabasoga dhamstrat antra sraja shratajakesha rashanku karnan nihrada pita digibad aribhinna kagrat. Satyadev Prabhu is laughing because when we travel together, we used to chant these verses over and over again. And this particular verse has this digibat, which means how elephants, they run in fear when they hear the roaring of Lord Nrisingadev. And in this verse, Prahlad Maharaj is describing the fearsome form of Lord Nrisingadev. Even Lakshmi Devi was afraid. This is serious business. When Vishnu gets mad, you know, everyone becomes afraid. Even his wife, she's looking and goes, I don't recognize him like this. Is that Vishnu really? You know, and all the big demigods came forward and they were afraid too. I mean, when God roars and he's screaming like that in anger, it's fearsome situation. You know, everyone was afraid. So my Lord, who are never conquered by anyone, I am certainly not afraid of your ferocious mouth and tongue. And this is Prahlad, he's only 5 years old. All the demigods were afraid. Lakshmi was afraid. None of them could pacify the Lord. So what do? They push Prahlad forward. They said, you try. And Srila Prabhupada once said, he said, it was like pushing a 5-year-old child into the cage of a lion. So Prahlad's saying, I'm not afraid. I'm certainly not afraid of your ferocious mouth and tongue, your eyes bright like the sun or your frowning eyebrows. I do not fear your sharp pinching teeth, your garland of intestines, your mane soaked with blood or your high wedge-like ears. Nor do I fear your tumultuous roaring, which makes elephants flee to different distant places, or your nails, which are meant to kill your enemies. Trastos myahang kripana vatsa ladusa hogra samsara chakra kadanad grasatam pranita balha sakarma birashatam atengri mulam pritopa varga sharanam huayase kadanu. O most powerful, insurmountable Lord, who are kind to the fallen souls. That means he's Kripana Vatsala. Does anybody know what Kripana means? It means a wretched, miserly kind of person. And this is one of Krishna's names, Kripana Vatsala. What's Vatsala mean? Huh?
No,
Loving like what?
Child.
Like a child? Like you ever seen a mother with its child, how delicately and, you know, she's just fawning over him and taking so much tender, loving care of the child? That's vatsal. Or like the cow, always thinking where the calf is, you know, and when the calf comes, then the milk comes when there's affection. It doesn't come just automatically. Mothers give milk when they have a little baby. Cows give milk when the calf is born. And how does the milk come? God of affection. This is the description of the spiritual world. Shriya kanta kanta parama purusha kalpataravo dhrma bumishchintam ni ganamayitam amritam. It's describing how there's oceans of milk coming there because there's so much affection. It's all flowing for Krishna. It's a huge, huge ocean of milk flowing. It's coming from affection for Krishna. Anyway, Krishna is the most affectionate. He's Kripana Vatsala, the most wretched person, the most miserly person. Krishna's affection to even that person, he's saying. This is the Prahlad Maharaj statement. Kripana Vatsala Dusha Hogra. You're kind even to the most fallen. Trastosmyahan Kripana Vatsala Dusha Hogra. Samsara Chakra Kadanad Grasatam Pranita. O most powerful, insurmountable Lord, who are kind to the fallen souls, to the Kripana Vatsals, I have been put into the association of demons as a result of my activities. See, Prahlad Maharaj was born into the family of Hiranyakashipu. Back then, that meant something. And therefore, I'm very much afraid of my condition of life within this material world. When will that moment come when you will call me to the shelter of your lotus feet, which are the ultimate goal for liberation from conditional life? Purport. Being in the material world is certainly miserable, but certainly when one was put into the association of asuras or atheistic men is intolerably so. One may ask why the living entity is put into the material world. Indeed, some foolish people deride the Lord for having put them here. Actually, everyone is put into conditional life according to his karma. Therefore, Prahlad Maharaj, representing all the conditioned souls, admits that he was put into life among the asuras because of the results of his karma. The Lord is known as Kripana Vatsala because he is extremely kind to the conditioned souls. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, therefore, the Lord appears whenever there are discrepancies in the execution of religious principles. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam srijamyaham. He comes to save us. The Lord is extremely anxious to deliver the conditioned souls, and therefore he instructs all of us to return home back to Godhead. Sarva dharman bharitya ja mamekam sharanam braja aham tam sarva pabebhyo mokshayishami masuchaha. Thus Prahlad Maharaj expected that the Lord, by his kindness, would call him again to the shelter of his lotus feet. In other words, everyone should be eager to return home back to Godhead, taking shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord and thus being fully trained in Krishna consciousness. Fact is, when we become more Krishna conscious, we'll develop a healthy fear of the material world. You know, example I always give, maybe it's a lame example, but you can tell me after class if it was. But I remember in school, when I was getting ready for an exam, if I was really nervous up to the last minute and studying with all my might up until the last second that I walked into the exam, not taking anything for granted that I was going to, you know, just do okay, I usually did really well. But when I gave up and I thought everything's okay, and I said, I don't have to concentrate the last half hour before the exam and everything. I usually bombed out somehow. And we should have a healthy fear all the time of Maya and always be testing ourselves and be cultivating Krishna consciousness and not, let down our guard and think, oh, it's okay just to slide or something like that. Because Maya is very powerful and can take us away from our real interest very easily. We become victimized by Maya. Yes, Prabhuji.
I like the point, we were discussing this point on the road down, and
Vaish gave the example of like a new investor. In the beginning of your life, if you're investing and you make some mistakes, you sort of have time to recover for those mistakes. We're talking about how devotional service is a lifetime process. And a lot of times in the beginning, we have enthusiasm, but sometimes we can't maintain it. Or we go, you know, at the same level for a long time and then become kind of lax. And then near the end, make some major blunder, you know, out of inattention or get into the wrong association. We see this happens to devotees sometimes too. But then it's too late to recover. So I think the older we get, the more tendency might be there to cruise. But that's the worst time to cruise because you might die.
Yeah, also we talked about like in a race, sometimes tactically, you know, when you're running a race, right? And you know, the ending part is the most important. You know, you want to make sure that you're there for it, you know, at the very end, and don't let up and quit right on the last part. Of course, devotional service is absolute, and whatever we do, you know, even if we fall down at a certain point or at any point, Krishna can make up for it somehow. But we should take it on ourselves to make sure that we don't fall asleep at the wheel. We do everything that we can to stay in devotional service and, you know, put ourselves in good association so that we can continue the process. And it's cumulative, too. So we shouldn't lose hope, also, because due to past conditioning and due to so many obstacles, we sometimes may feel a little overwhelmed. You know, that, oh, I've tried so many times and I've failed, that we can also maybe lose a little bit of enthusiasm. But we can also see that Krishna is so kind that everything we do has a cumulative effect in devotional service, and that we shouldn't give up hope and think that, you know, because I've tried before and then I haven't been able to make the standard, that maybe I shouldn't just try at all. But we should go on trying, and we'll be probably very surprised because in a cumulative way, Krishna will, the result will come, it is sure. And even if we're only able to reach a certain level of what we feel is a very humble level, if we can just maintain that, whatever level we can do, and maintain that, it's very powerful over time. Very powerful. I've seen it myself. I wanted to, since we're coming to the end of class, I wanted to say something about my experience over the last week. First of all, I wanted to thank all of the devotees who had called me to give prayers and condolences for my mother, who passed away last Saturday. And I really appreciated it, all of you, you know, that you made prayers here and that you had written me and or called me. And because it is, even though we may cultivate throughout our lives, I know when I was 15 years old, I started reading Bhagavad Gita, and then when I was 16, practically, I walked away from my family. I really kind of gave him the cold shoulder because I had to. I realized at that point maybe a carryover from my last life or something that I have to break away from family life. And at first it was very difficult actually because I was attached somewhere in my heart, and I can remember the first time when I was at that age and they went on vacation and I said, I'm not going, I'm staying home to meditate and stuff like that. And I remember when they left, I felt sort of a pang, like, you know, a pang of separation. But then gradually I gained strength. Krishna gave me the intelligence and the power at that time to actually to go away and to leave. And I spent many years in the Brahmacharya ashram. I didn't even come home and visit them for 8 years, which was kind of a sign of the times. But, of course, they came and visited me sometimes. But my point was that though later on I redeveloped my relationship with them, which was always there to some degree because they were very kind to me my whole life and always supported me even though I sort of just walked away from them. Then But my point was that even though I've cultivated through my life a knowledge that, well, this isn't really my eternal family, and you know my mother is another living entity who's taken care of me in this lifetime, still there's a really strong attachment. I noticed that my father passed away 2 years ago when I was in Vrindavan, and just losing my mother, whom I was very close to, it's a very moving experience, very, very difficult. And so I could see that, you know, cultivating knowledge, spiritual life, it's very deep, actually. We have a very deep attachment to this world. And so the experience of being close to my mother when she was leaving, and she had decided to leave because she had really all of a sudden become afflicted by old age. She was very healthy up until she was about 90 years old. However, after my father left, they had been married for 67 years, and I think that separation really was too much to take, and she was finding it very hard physically also in the last year, and even in the last few months. The doctors couldn't even give it a diagnosis, but she was losing altitude. And then she decided that she wasn't going to do it anymore. So she decided to stop eating and drinking, and that's what she did. It took her 5 days. But she knew exactly what she was doing, and she was conscious when she did. And going through the whole experience with her, spending time with her, watching her make the decision, and watching her go through the process of leaving her body, and all, I guess one of the main realizations that I wanted to pass on was I saw how, because of her cumulative connection or contribution to Krishna consciousness throughout her lifetime, mainly by supporting me, and you know, in small ways. It wasn't that she embraced the philosophy or anything like that. In fact, there was never any much scope for me to talk to her about it, you know, throughout my life. She was a college professor, intellectual, and it wasn't something that, you know, that she really wanted to. We never went in that direction so much. But she supported me, as I said, and there were ways in which that she just showed her appreciation for it and thought it was an okay thing, I guess probably because I was involved with it. In any case, at Christmas time last year, I may have told some of you this, but spontaneously, I was going over to see her on Christmas, and I took with me a Harinam chatter and some japa beads, japa bag, counter beads, things like that. And I was sitting with her and my brother and after dinner, and I just said, okay, I brought you something for Christmas. And here it is. And I put the Harinam chatter on her, and I said, you know, and here's your beads. And my brother was there, and he said, well, you have to give her a spiritual name, you know, because he kind of knows how the whole thing works. So I said, I just spontaneously said, your name is Jamuna. She goes, oh, Jamuna. So I gave her the beads, and I showed her how to chant the Maha Mantra on the beads. And to my surprise, she started chanting. And I took a little film of it because I didn't want to miss it. And you know, I just had it on my camera, and I put it on there, and she started chanting on the beads, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. The first couple mantras, you know, she tripped over a couple words or whatever, but then she started getting it down. And so she called me and my wife the next day, and she said that, you know, in the night she had like a tough night. You know, she hadn't slept and she was in anxiety about something, but she said, I woke up the next morning and I said, I'm Jamuna. And she went, she said, I got my beads and I started chanting. And she said, this is good, this works for me. So from that point, she started chanting. That was during December. And from time to time, when we go to visit her, we saw that she was still doing it. I don't think she was doing 16 rounds or anything like that, but she was taking shelter of the chanting. And she would refer to herself when she'd write me in an email as Jamuna. And for years, I'd never, you know, it was like, love mom or whatever, you know. But now our relationship had changed. It was uncanny in a way. But it really became pronounced when she decided to leave her body, because everything changes at that point. All your relationships, your whole way you view the world changes. And when I found out from my brother that she had decided to leave, which was very sudden, actually, although she was struggling physically, he called me on Tuesday morning and said, I think this is it. She's decided she's not going to do this anymore, and she's decided she's not taking any medications, she's not going to eat, she's not going to drink, and she's going to leave her body. So I went over there to visit her, and you know, she was already in her bed getting ready, you know, that was the place she stayed for the rest of the time. So I went in, and as soon as I got there, I was there, my brother was there. I walked in, and she had been sleeping. She opened her eyes and she said, "I'm Jamuna. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare." And I started crying because I was thinking, like, how could I have expected this ever, you know? Like sometimes people say, well, how do I preach to my parents? You know, like the answer is you don't. You just live your life and be Krishna conscious and, you know, let Krishna do what he does. And I was amazed. And she kept chanting. And I was really overwhelmed. And so it was Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. She left Saturday morning. But she was fully conscious up until Friday night. And Sangeeta, who is a famous hospice nurse, is a devotee, when we called her Tuesday night and told her that my mom had decided she's going to leave her body, she immediately flew out to help us. Because it's very difficult also, you know, when you're leaving your body, you also have to be comfortable. That's what hospice does. And it's not that you're leaving your body, so who cares? No, it's, you know, you should be in a comfortable position somewhere where, you know, you're not in so much pain that you can't say the mantra, you can't concentrate. So Sangeeta came out. She's really expert. You know, when somebody's bedridden like that, you have to move them every 2 hours so that they don't, you know, circulation doesn't cut off and things like that. And many other things, you know, you have to give a sponge bath and... So she came, and Nirkula was there, and then we had some other hospice nurse that came in from Kaiser that was covered under insurance, but they only came a couple times. But it was that there were devotees there the whole time with her, taking care of her physically, and then many of her friends came over. She was able to say goodbye to them, and it was holding long conversations up until Friday. And Friday was, there are many things that she said during those times, especially to me and Nirkula and Sangeeta and things that we remembered in a special way because of the fact that they were related to Krishna consciousness, which I won't go into all the details right now. But just as an overall summary, that Friday night, you know, when you die, actually there are many different stages that you go through. And somebody who's expert and has been there, like Sangeeta, can see all the stages, you know, that you go through when you're leaving your body. It's a gradual process. And Satyadev would know, too, because I'm sure he's seen it many times. And so on Friday night, you know, she started closing down. And the last thing she said, again, to Sangeeta and Nirkula was, "I am Jamuna, Hare Krishna." And those were basically her last words. She had mentioned something earlier about how she's waiting for a door to open. And that night, Friday night, she was not responding, but she was making some noises, like she was trying to talk or something like that. And Sangeeta said to her, you know, she was stroking her face, and she said, you know, be a little patient. She said, that door will open for you very soon. And I was sitting there right there watching, and I saw that as soon as she said that, she smiled. So I saw that, you know, that was there. And then so we stayed up with her the whole night because we knew she was going to leave. So we took turns staying up, and we all chanted. We just sat there and chanted and chanted, and then we had moved a recording of Prabhupada chanting in the background also. So that was going on. Meanwhile, I had set up behind her an altar. I had shalagram, and I had a little, you know, a deity of Krishna and Prabhupada and many other things. And we had put neck beads on her and had a Harinam chatter just around her head on the pillow and things like that, which is kind of a miracle too, because I don't know, maybe in some families there could be some clash or something like that, but everything went very smoothly. And so we stayed up with her all night, and the next morning at I was sitting with her for about 2 hours just chanting and chanting and chanting, and then all of a sudden she just took her last breath, and I was realizing how there is a last breath. You know how we get so many breaths during the day and you just take them for granted? Well, you get one last one. And every one of us here will have one last breath at some time. We don't know when it'll be. You know, it may come without warning, or we may get 4 days notice or something. It's kind of fortunate when you do know, when you say, well, I have 4 days and this is going to be it. Then you know, you can be aware that it's going to happen. You know, but anyway, I felt very fortunate because I was right there when I saw her take her last breath. And so we had tulsi leaves that had been offered to Krishna's lotus feet. And of course, we intensified the chanting, and I put the tulsi leaves in her mouth. And we had Ganga water and water from Radhakund. We put in her head and some in her mouth and things like that. And we could see, you can see that the soul is leaving the body. You can actually see it. And so as we were chanting and she left from that position, it was right at 6:51 in the morning. And it was just as the sun was starting to come up. The sky had just turned red and the light just started to come from the horizon. And then we could tell she was gone. And of course, Sangeeta was checking her vital signs to see. And then there was a difference. You know, there had been a soul in the body, and now there was obviously no soul in the body. So one thing I was going to say is that I saw how there was a cumulative effect throughout her life of whatever contribution, you know, she made to Krishna consciousness that allowed her at the very end, the last couple of months, just to embrace, take shelter of the holy names is really what she did. She really took shelter of the fact that she was Jamuna. And she wasn't afraid. There was no fear. Sangeeta said it. She'd seen many people leave their body, but she could see she had no fear, and she was determined to do it. Other people came in and said, "You sure you want to do this?" You know, friends, and like, "Why don't you try, you know, some more?" And she was just determined, but there was no fear. So anyway, it gave me a lot of confidence in the process of Krishna consciousness, and in also taking shelter of the holy name, and also that I'm going to die. Because sometimes, you know, you could think, well, you know, we hear about death, lots of people are talking about dying and things like that, but I'll probably never die. But we will. And there's a process that we're going to go through. And really, we're going through it now. It's just that we don't really think about it. I think about so many other things. So whatever we're doing in Krishna consciousness is very valuable. Our contribution is very valuable because as I saw the relatives around me who are not particularly cultivating spiritual life become acutely aware. In fact, I heard one of my older brothers talking on the telephone to somebody who he was explaining how she was getting ready to leave, say that this world is not the absolute. I can see that now. And we are not our bodies. You know, these realizations come fast and furious when you're near someone leaving their body. And it becomes very apparent. So Krishna consciousness is all important. Other things are going on as status quo, and they're not so important. And they won't be important at the end. The things that we have, the possessions that we have, they all get divided up and passed on to other people who will pass them on to other people. You know, what we can accumulate in this life is not very important at all. And especially when that comes to that last moment. So an intelligent person will cultivate this and understand that, you know, my real value will come in my relationship with the Holy Name. This is where we can hang on. So develop the relationship with the holy sound. It's very different. It's absolutely 100% different than the material sound. And it is stationary. It's non-moving. Whereas everything in this material world is not stationary. It's not moving. I mean, it is moving all the time. We can't hold on to it. It's flickering. But the Holy Name we can hold on to. So therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives us this advice. Just cultivate this. Concentrate here. One time, try to get this feeling that this is all. This is everything that's important. There's nothing more valuable to be had in the three worlds than this. And that's what we're doing here. We're all here to help each other, to cultivate this, and to some way or another hold ourselves up in our, you know, in our struggles in the material existence so that we can continue to hear and chant together and to prepare to go back to Godhead. And that's the ultimate goal. Thank you for indulging me. I'm also, you know, to tell these things is therapeutic for me because it's, you know, something that to talk to, you know, your beloved friends about these things is very, you know, reveal your heart. It's healing, you know, healing. And that's the stage I'm in now. Hare Krishna.